Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Superpowers, Year 1, Part 1, by Drew Hayes. Narrated by Jonathan Lee Taylor and performed by a full cast. Two well-dressed men in black suits and black ties materialized outside of a small, white brick building. The taller of the two pulled out a miniature notepad, made an entry with a slash of a few pen strokes, and then stowed it away once more. The shorter man pulled out a pair of sunglasses and put them on, in an attempt to fight back the sun's penetrating glare. Then turned to his companion.
Where are we, Mr. Transport?
The taller man adjusted the sunglasses he had put on before they departed.
Arizona, Mr. Numbers.
I was under the impression our next case was in Colorado.
He was, however. There was an incident last week. Circumstances required that he be moved to a location able to accommodate his specific needs.
I see.
With that, the two men walked around to the front of the building and proceeded inward. They were stopped as soon as they entered by a man wearing a white lab coat.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've been expecting you. My name is Dr. Hubert.
Mr. Numbers cocked his eyebrow slightly, and Mr. Transport replied with an almost imperceptible nod. This exchange took the place of actual conversation, which would have consisted of Mr. Numbers asking if their contact's name had checked out, and Mr. Transport reporting that it had.
We'd like to see the boy.
No, of course you would. However, first, I'm afraid I must ask you to take off anything electrical. Watches, phones, anything with a battery must go. I do hope neither of you has a pacemaker.
Neither Mr. Numbers nor Mr. Transport had pacemakers. They did both carry expensive, high-powered phones, though, as well as top-of-the-line watches and a pair of taser guns. All of these were deposited into a small safe in the front lobby area, with Dr. Hubert's adamant assurances that everything would be returned once they were done. Neither of the men showed any concern for their valuables. Once that was completed, Dr. Hubert pulled out a small candle and lit it, then repeated the procedure twice more, until all three men were equipped. Dr. Hubert kept expecting one of the men to ask why they had shed their electronics and were being handed candles in the middle of the day. They did not. The doctor then led them into a dimly lit hallway covered in green tile. They made their way down it, coming to a solid steel door at the end. The doctor made a quick series of punches on the keypad, and the door released, opening to reveal total darkness. As the trio stepped through, the door shut behind them, leaving them with only their candles to see by. Inside was what looked like a large concrete bunker with a sizable glass window peering into the next room. Though both men strained and held up their candles, they couldn't make out anything in the pitch black on the other side of the glass.
He's normally more stable than this, but unfortunately he was trying to fix his toaster a few days ago and received a nasty electrical shock.
So that's why a quarter of Colorado lost power last week.
Yes. Before he was able to sever the connection, he had drained his own city's power supply, along with that of all the areas surrounding it. We're trying to help him burn off all that electricity, but it comes in spurts and is almost impossible to predict.
I see.
It's also affecting his natural abilities. That's why I had to remove all electrical devices and why we're keeping him out of the sunlight. He's been pulling from anything that gets even remotely close to him.
As if on cue, the flame of Mr. Numbers' candle jerked violently in the direction of the window and went dark.
I'm sorry he's not more stable today.
Well, if he were, he wouldn't be in consideration for our program.
Oh. Does that mean you're still counting him as a possibility?
There will be some preliminary testing and an interview process, but if I were to offer my opinion, I would say we have a very viable candidate on the other side of that glass.
Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport next materialized before a hospital in Nevada. Mr. Transport again produced his notepad, jotting down a few scribbles, and then put it back where it belonged.
Another incident?
Par for the course with this one, to my understanding.
The duo entered the hospital and headed upstairs. It was something of a walk to get where they were heading, and by the time they were done, they had crossed out of the main hospital building and into a more run-down wing. The doctors here were fewer and more haggard, and the walls looked worn down and repainted. Hospitals were never what Mr. Transport thought of as cheerful. But this area was enough to inspire one to end it all, which very well might have been the point. Mr. Numbers stopped at the appropriate room, and the two entered. It was like the rest of the wing, worn down, beat up, and hopeless. Though this room had two unique additions. A young man lying in a hospital bed, and a recently exploded television that was still smoking.
Mr. Campbell, a pleasure to meet you.
Call me Nick.
The boy wore a hospital gown, and seemed to have taken the time to gel his thick hair.
I take it you two are my interview committee?
Indeed. What happened to the television?
Beats me. I went to turn the thing on, and I guess the tube's overloaded or something.
I see.
Mr. Numbers quickly flipped through Nick's chart.
So, according to the records, you won a $10,000 scratch-off ticket, after which you were hit by a bus while celebrating in the street, which knocked you into a bounce house that had been set up nearby. A bounce house whose motor had the poor timing to overload and explode after your impact. Do I have everything correct?
You might want to tack on that my winnings barely covered my hospital bill and the damages I owed to the bounce house owner.
You were held accountable for the damages?
Well, you know how it is. People tend to blame my kind first and ask questions later.
We know, Mr. Campbell. That's exactly what brought us here today.
Mr. Transport walked over to the room's entrance and shut the door firmly. The two men next appeared in a forest. This wasn't a forest in the sense of parks that can seem sprawling, or a cluster of spruces that form on the side of an untended highway. This was a forest in an ancient and powerful sense, with massive trees that served as ecosystems within ecosystems. This was a place untouched, and unaware of all the progress Homo sapiens had made within their pitiful time upon the Earth. Untouched, that is, with the exception of the trailer, a few feet away from Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport. Sitting in a rocking chair, sipping a glass of lemonade, was a young girl whose file said 17, but whose face said 14. She was wiry and lean, with short hair that poked up in several different directions. She stared at the two of them, unblinkingly, and the two stared right back at her. The three of them stood in silence for several minutes, the girl's eyes flitting between the two of them, theirs remaining constant on her. At last, the girl took a long sip of her lemonade.
That sounds lovely.
A simultaneous nod came from Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport. And then they were gone.
Herschel, come downstairs. The nice men are here to see you.
Sally Daniels, a dowdy woman now in her 50s, set a kettle and cups on the coffee table in front of Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport.
Are you sure I can't get you gentlemen anything to eat?
Thank you, Miss Daniels, but we are quite comfortable.
Oh, no need for that. Please, call me Sally.
Good morrow, my men.
Herschel Daniels descended the stairs into the bright yellow kitchen. He was a portly young man in a forest green shirt, hidden underneath the rich, royal purple of his cape.
Why are you wearing a cape?
It's a cloak. After we partake in a large lunch, my men and I are taking the castle up at Rothring Peak and doing battle with a foul vampire lord.
My little Herschel is a bit overly creative. He and his friends are active in the community's live-action role-playing club.
Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport exchanged a look that needed no clarification.
Well, we don't want to keep you. However, we were hoping to speak with Roy, if that's at all possible.
Oh, of course. Everyone wants to talk to Roy.
Well, it's just that we have some things to discuss with him.
I'm sorry, I don't think he'll be around today. He went to a country bar last night and, well, he usually doesn't show up for a while after uproars like that.
Ah, that does explain the cleanup crew that was dispatched this morning.
If that's the case, then we will be on our way. We don't want to keep you from your activities, but we will need to speak with Roy at a later date.
Wait!
Herschel jumped to his feet.
I know what you hear about, and I really want to get in. I'm tired of living like this, never knowing when it'll happen, never knowing where I'll wake up. Please, if you can help me control it, please don't leave.
It's okay, Herschel.
Mr. Transport patted the boy on his shoulder.
We aren't giving up on you just because of a reschedule. You're a serious candidate for our program. I promise, We'll be back once we can talk to Roy as well.
Herschel nodded and turned away quickly, so the two men wouldn't see the tears forming in his eyes. He didn't know what his chances were at the moment, but he was smart enough to guess that crying in front of the agents wouldn't help things. Mr. Numbers tapped impatiently on Mr. Transport's shoulder and gestured to his watch. Mr. Transport nodded and then turned his head to Miss Daniels.
Thank you for the tea.
The duo appeared in a sprawling garden under a gazebo and next to a pair of wicker chairs. There was a small serving cart on the far side of a stone table. Sitting next to the cart and sipping on a cocktail was a man in a white, open-throated shirt and a pair of khakis. The man was getting on in years, but wore them unbelievably well. The signs of age seemed to draw out and enhance his features rather than muddle them.
I'm glad you could make it.
Our pleasure, Mr. Adair.
For the first time all day, for the first time in years, really, the pair was showing signs of nervousness. They had been told about their required presence for this meeting, but not about the subject matter it concerned. That left both of them feeling something they were not accustomed to. Vulnerable.
Sit. Can I get you something to drink?
Oh, I'd like a gin and tonic, if it's no trouble, sir.
This was their final meeting of the day, so Mr. Transport didn't see the harm of indulging just a bit.
Just water for me, thanks.
Mr. Numbers was already writing out the riot act he was going to read Mr. Transport for asking for alcohol while on the job. But facially, he was working hard to keep everything upbeat and positive. Mr. Adair pulled two glasses from the cart at his side, then a carafe, from which he poured water into both. He handed the glass, as it was, to Mr. Numbers, but dipped his finger into Mr. Transport's. Immediately, the liquid bubbled and fizzled, stabilizing seconds later when Mr. Adair handed the glass to Mr. Transport.
I know you boys are busy, so I won't mince words. You're here because you two are the admissions committee for the new program.
Well, it isn't quite that simple. There are evaluations and approvals and whatnot.
Humility is wasted on the powerful, Mr. Numbers. You are two of the most trusted agents in your company, and with good reason. You both have abilities that could have made you well-known heroes. Instead, you chose to do the same work without the prestige. You are loyal, reliable, and dependable. Whomever you recommend for this program will be who gets in. You know it. I know it. And everyone who matters knows it.
Mr. Adair poured himself a glass of water and swirled his finger about until the liquid turned a deep golden hue.
So, with that said, I asked you here to meet me because there will be one addition to the program that you will both endorse fully.
And who would that be, sir?
My daughter, Alice. She is a power born with superhuman abilities. But unlike a super, she lacks the capacity to freely control them. Though I'm sure your thorough friend here has already found that out.
Mr. Adair gestured to Mr. Transport.
My research said that she was in the non-lethal category. She flies, correct?
You are correct, Mr. Transport. My daughter's power is tethered to her emotions, so when she gets happy, she winds up bouncing off the ceiling. If we're lucky enough to have a ceiling over her at the time.
Forgive me for saying this, but the program's initial testing cases are supposed to be powers with desirable abilities that are currently a danger to themselves and others.
I know. That's why I called you here to tell you that you would recommend her, instead of going through the channels to submit her as a viable specimen.
With all due respect, Mr. Adair, that would compromise both our duties to the program and to the company.
Mr. Adair leaned back in his wicker chair and stirred his drink with his finger. As he stirred, the colors changed, going through a rainbow of shades and depths until it finally settled on a light pink.
Mr. Transport, you know what my code name is, correct?
The Alchemist.
Right. And you know why I am called that, yes?
Because you have the ability to manipulate and change the properties of matter.
Correct again. So maybe what you are missing is my role in this world. You see, while other supers defend their homes or countries, I defend our economy. I turn radioactive sludge into oil, rocks into gold, worthlessness into pricelessness. Most supers seek to garner favor from politicians and leaders. Leaders and politicians work to garner favor from me. I am one of the primary shareholders of the company you both work for, as well as several other powerful corporations. I'm not going to threaten either of you because we all know my abilities are ill-suited to a physical altercation. I'm simply going to tell you that you will recommend my daughter for the first trial of the new program. End of story.
Mm-mm. Yes, sir.
Good. I'm glad we understand each other. So, when will things get started?
6 months later. Vince adjusted his backpack to put its weight on his other shoulder. 2 months since the procedure had ended and he'd been put in recovery, his body still felt like it was aching and healing. He was walking across the beautiful, sprawling college campus of Lander University, passing other kids his age and blending in like a normal person. Well, almost, anyway. His hair still made him stand out. It was silver, and not old man silver. Silver like moonbeams glinting off steel. It wasn't that it was unattractive. In fact, it accentuated Vince's bright blue eyes. The problem was that his hair marked him as different. And after all these years, Vince was yearning to be nothing more than a face in the crowd.
Well, at least this is California.
Vince quickened his steps. He was getting second glances from the other students, but not as many as he was used to. He also passed a few people whose looks made him do double takes of his own. It was comforting, in a mutual freak sort of way.
Huh?
The building Vince walked up to looked less like a dorm and more like a medium-sized house. He didn't see how it was possible to fit so many people into this one-story brick home, but he trusted that whoever was managing housing had that in hand. Vince entered the house and shifted his backpack once more. It bounced on his shoulder lightly, far from stuffed, with only Vince's few articles of clothing and worldly possessions in it. Travel light, move quick, stay alive. That was the code that kept Vince breathing and his abilities in check. But that was behind him. In front of Vince was a cream-colored wall with a notice welcoming him to Millbrook Hall. There was another wall to his left and a hallway to his right. The notice had an arrow directing him to follow the hall and then take a left. Vince did as he was told and found himself looking at a sturdy door with no window or discernible handle. There was only a small box jutting out with an oval-shaped green pad on top. Vince might not have been the most up-to-date with technology, but even he could figure this one out. He pressed his thumb to the oval, and after a moment, he stepped through the door, out of the foyer and into what looked more like a living room than anything else. There were several couches and chairs set up, a coffee table in the center of the room, and a large flat-screen television on the wall directly across from him. Everything was decorated in white and red and smelled like an odd combination of flowers and chemicals. On each wall, perpendicular to the entrance, were two metal doors and a scanner with a sign above each. The one to the left of the entrance was labeled Boys, while the one to the right was designated Girls. Vince went over to the television, only to notice an open doorway beside it. He walked through it and found himself in a white-tiled kitchen. It had a large sink and a stove with multiple burners and a griddle, and all kinds of cooking knick-knacks that Vince had neither the knowledge nor the experience to make anything out of. At the back of the kitchen, on the right, was a cupboard, which Vince opened to discover a fully stocked pantry. On the left was another metal door. This one, however, had neither a sign above it nor a fingerprint scanner. Vince walked out of the kitchen and back into the living room, then over to the boys' door. As he walked, he carefully skirted away from the wall outlets whenever possible. He hadn't had an accident since the procedure, but that didn't mean he was eager to test his luck. Pressing his thumb to the scanner, the door opened, and Vince walked into what he could only assume was the common room. There was a television on the far end, along with pool and ping-pong tables. The other end of the room held a set of dartboards and a wooden door with the word bathroom on it. Opposite the entrance, there were three more metal doors. These had scanners clearly in place, but no signs. They were numbered 1, 2, and 3. With a shrug and a heft of his pack, Vince walked over to the middle door. He pressed his thumb down and waited for the beep, but this time, all that came out was a harsh buzzer. He tried twice more, before giving up and trying the room on the left, which was room 1. This time, the door buzzer opened, though Vince couldn't help noticing a chime that followed the usual opening sounds. He wasn't sure what that meant. and the sight before him left him little free brain space in which to contemplate it.
Whoa.
Saying his room was luxurious would be an overstatement, but it was definitely more opulent than Vince was accustomed to. There was a large bed in one corner, with a desk and computer set in the other. Between the two was a huge window, with sunlight streaming through blue curtains. The floor was carpeted, and as Vince walked across it, he saw that opposite the desk, there was a closet next to a chest of drawers. Slipping his pack off, Vince walked over and pulled open a drawer, trying to figure out if he had enough clothing to warrant any kind of organizational system. He was shocked to see that the drawer he'd opened already contained many pairs of socks and boxers. Checking the next drawer, he found shorts, then t-shirts. He slammed the door shut quickly.
Crud, this is someone else's room.
Vince turned on his heels, snatched up his backpack, and bolted for the door, which landed him face to face with a taller boy standing in the doorway, wearing sunglasses and running a comb through his dark brown hair.
Hey.
Vince froze, staring at the room's owner and wondering how to explain the mix-up. It wasn't his fault, after all. But this still wasn't the first impression he'd wanted to make on his new dorm mate.
Dude, that is some rockin' hair.
Thank you. Sorry I'm in your room. The door opened and I didn't know.
Oh, you're not in my room, neighbor. You're in your room. I'm in too. I heard you trying to buzz into mine and realized someone else was here, so I came to say hi.
But this can't be my room. It already has sheets and clothes and everything.
Yeah, my guess is that's because they thought you needed those things. The doors are keyed to us. They only open for the right person. If this room opened for you, then it's because it's your room. Did you even read the letter they gave you?
Letter?
I'll get mine. Hang on a sec. What's your name?
Vince.
Nice. You can call me Nick.
Nick stepped out of the room and returned moments later holding a white piece of paper with folded lines across it.
Here we go. Rooms have been set up for each attending member by the program. These will be stocked for members as deemed necessary and are keyed to each attendee's individual fingerprints. Communal areas are open to all, but will be under the jurisdiction of your administrators. You are expected to be in the central common room promptly at 7 p.m. on move-in day to meet with your administrators and go over dorm rules.
Lucky you held on to that, or I wouldn't have even known about the meeting, let alone my room.
Vince plunked down on his bed, shedding his backpack.
Good choice of words.
Nick pulled out the chair from Vince's desk and helped himself to a seat.
What do you mean?
It's nothing. It's just, well, you said lucky.
And what about it?
Nick pulled a set of dice from his jeans and closed his eyes, an act only visible despite his sunglasses due to the over-exaggerating scrunching of his face. Then he tossed the dice onto the desk.
Double sixes.
Nick took the dice again, closed his eyes once more, and threw them on the table again.
Double sixes. Again. So, you use trick dice?
Try them.
He scooped up the dice and offered them to Vince. Vince got off the bed, looked at the dice from Nick's hand, and examined them. They had six different numbers on each side, and felt as though they were weighted normally. He threw the dice on the desk for himself.
3 and 5. So, you know how to spin them.
Do it again.
This time, Nick closed his eyes and didn't exhale until Vince's throw hit the table.
Double ones. So,
throw them again.
Vince repeated his throw 3 more times. Each time, Nick closed his eyes and Vince wound up with double ones. After the 3rd time, Vince let the dice rest on the table. He went back to his bed and sat on the edge.
Are you telekinetic? Is that how you control the landing?
Nah, I can't move things with my mind. At least, not on purpose. My power is luck. It can be good or it can be bad, but if it's luck, then I got some say over it.
Luck? How does that work? Not to insult, I just tend to think of luck as more of an abstract concept than a viable ability.
No insult taken. I don't really know how it works. The docs tried to explain it to me. Something about quantum probabilities and minute alterations in the fabric of reality. But at the end of the day, all I know is that it's luck. And mine is a lot better since I got it under control.
That must have been pretty terrible before.
It was and it wasn't. At least my ability came in 2 flavors. You know, I kissed a supermodel once. She was out with some friends and they played spin the bottle at the restaurant we were both at and, well, it pointed to me. Of course, then I went outside to find my car had caught fire, but hey, you gotta take the good with the bad.
You're certainly upbeat about this.
Sure am. That's all in the past. We're not like that anymore. We're the first people in history to go from being powered to being super. I still don't understand what they did to us for those months, and I don't care. Far as I'm concerned, getting into that program was the best stroke of luck my ability ever gave me.
So why the sunglasses?
If anyone in authority asks, it's because using my power can give me headaches that leave me sensitive to light. But between you and me, I just think they make me look cool. What about your hair? Natural?
Unfortunately. One of those weird traits people with abilities sometimes get. The damn stuff basically drinks dye too, so there's no way for me to change the color.
You could shave it.
Tried it once. Some guys can pull off the bald look. I'm just not one of those guys. I'd rather be the weirdo with silver hair than a man baby.
An understandable choice. Well, with you here, that rounds out the boys' side. I wonder if any of the girls have gotten here yet.
Wait, who's our third roommate?
He got here early and went out to explore the campus. You'll see him tonight at the dorm meeting. He's an interesting fellow.
That doesn't sound good.
No, but it doesn't sound bad either. Come on, I'm famished. Let's go hit up a dining hall for lunch.
Do you know where one is?
Not really, but I bet we get lucky.
Alice saw a pair of boys walking away from the building as she was heading toward it. They took no notice of her, clearly absorbed in their own conversation and playing catch with a pair of dice. Her new roommates, no doubt.
Fantastic. Well, at least the one with the brown hair is cute. Or he would be if he weren't wearing those ridiculous sunglasses. The other one, though, who's he trying to impress with that hair? Is he trying to flunk the secret identity challenge before the semester has even started? Well, in any case, it's none of my concern.
Alice's father had been strangely unbending in denying her desire to dorm with the regular supers, saying that she had to stay in the dorm set up for the special cases like herself. She didn't really see why she needed to be in the reinforced building. Her ability was only flying, and she had suffered no uncontrollable attacks for months now. Alice didn't want to find camaraderie with those who shared her former disability. She wanted to forget that part of her life had ever existed. Still, no one could say that Alice Adair didn't make the best of a bad situation. She had taken a guiding hand in the construction of their dormitory, creating an environment that was spacious, desirable, and, above all else, elite. She breezed through the hallway, disregarding the note that hung on the entrance. A quick thumb scan took her to the central common room. She surveyed the work of the decorators critically. Yes, it would do nicely. Now, at least, when the other students asked her why she was in this small dorm at the edge of campus, she could humbly explain that it was only available to those of sufficient means to afford such luxury and privacy. It wasn't her ideal situation, but it would work. Alice moved briskly to the girls' side, anxious to get through and avoid encountering any of the boys. The girls' side was identical to the boys', save that there were only two rooms, numbered 4 and 5. While group bathrooms were fine for her roommates, Alice had been quite insistent with Daddy that she have her own private bathroom. The fact that this meant her fellow female roommate received one as well was merely an afterthought. Alice noticed her roommate sitting in one of the plush pink chairs she had picked out, watching a game show on the muted television. The girl watched silently, occasionally cocking her head to a different angle.
She looks wild.
It was the first word that popped into Alice's head. Not wild in the sense of tequila, poor decisions, and eventual therapy, but wild like a jungle. Her hair looked as though no one had touched it for years, sticking up at all angles.
At least her clothing is clean. Though it looks like she's worn the same thing for years.
Ironically, Alice's jeans had the same appearance, but hers had achieved the look through corporate innovation and the fashion demands of the public. The most discerning thing about the girl, though, was her eyes. While Alice had always considered her own green eyes, especially when paired with her platinum blonde hair, to be rather stunning, they held no candle to the amber irises that encircled this girl's pupils.
Good afternoon. I take it that you're my dorm mate?
The girl swiveled her head toward Alice in a motion that seemed more bird-like than human. She blinked her round amber eyes twice, then gave an odd grin.
You snuck up on me.
Oh, well, I do apologize.
Don't apologize. I just keep forgetting people can do that now. It's a pleasant surprise every time.
All right, then.
Alice shifted her feet uncomfortably. She knew everyone staying here had an ability, but Daddy never warned her of what to expect.
My name is Alice. What do you go by?
The girl blinked oddly once more, then cocked her head.
I haven't had any need to go by anything in a long time. My given name is Mary, though it might take me a few tries to get my attention with it. As I said, I'm out of practice.
Alice didn't truly care, but she couldn't go around referring to the girl as Freak Eyes all year. At least not out loud.
I think Mary is a lovely name.
I'll do my best to remember it's mine.
Mary turned her head back to the television and continued watching her show.
If you don't mind me asking, why are you watching that on mute?
Mary replied without turning around.
I used to always watch television like this. I learned to read their lips. That way, if I wanted silence, all I had to do was shut my eyes. It was the only thing in my life where I could actually turn the voices off, so I've relished it. I guess old habits die hard.
Ah, I see.
The girl had made her feel uncomfortable. It felt to Alice like, despite being so disconnected, Mary was looking right through her. Alice had grown up in wealth and privacy, and if there was one thing she couldn't stand, it was the sensation that someone knew what she was thinking. She eyed room number 4 and began edging her way toward it.
Well, I'll leave you to that then. See you tonight at the meeting.
With those words, Alice jammed her thumb on her door scanner and popped it open. She slammed the door immediately after her. Mary remained seated in her chair, eyes still trained on her game show. She whispered to a small stuffed bear that sat between her leg and the armrest of the chair.
That girl is more perceptive than she thinks.
I told you we got lucky.
Nick munched on a thick hamburger.
We didn't get lucky. We got lost for a half an hour until I went into a building and asked for directions.
And wasn't it lucky I brought along a guy with no masculinity issues to ask for directions?
I think you're stretching on this one.
Vince picked at a basket of chicken fingers. Being a wanderer had given him a pretty ironclad stomach when it came to grease and taste, but he'd also always had to subsist on whatever was available at the time. As a result, he had a small appetite and an equally small body. He reflected ruefully that if he just had some muscle on his wiry frame, it would have been very pronounced.
I might be stretching, but then again, you haven't even told me what you can do. Who knows if you're fit to judge the skills of others?
We're in public. You know we can't talk about that kind of stuff.
Oh, please.
Nick took another bite of his burger and guzzled down some soda.
We're at one of only 5 colleges in the nation that offer certification for supers to become the government-approved responders known as heroes. Everyone in this cafeteria is probably a super in disguise.
The young men paused for a moment and looked around. Besides themselves, there was a small group of ladies halfway across the dining hall and a large table of boys and girls clear on the other end.
Come on, take a bite.
No, I told you, I'm a vegetarian.
No one in the room looked particularly super, or even interesting for that matter, except for a girl with short pink and black hair sitting with a friend. Vince noticed her as he did his visual sweep. Even without the colored hair, something about her stood out.
Okay. Maybe half the people.
According to the doctors who told me about this place, less than half of 1% of the student population is enrolled in the Hero Certification Program. So, odds are pretty good you and I are the only people with abilities here.
Less than half of 1%? That seems really low.
There are a lot more humans than supers. Even if this is only one of 5 schools, Lander is still a big university. A lot of people are going to come here wanting a run-of-the-mill education.
Poor bastards. All kinds of awesome stuff going on around them and they have no clue about it.
They better not. I heard that keeping your abilities a secret is like half of your grade. They say if you're found out, you have to do some kind of awful makeup course to graduate. And that's only an option if you're at the top of the class.
Vince unthinkingly ran his hands through his hair.
Don't worry about the do. I didn't think it meant anything significant, and I already knew you had some sort of power when we met. Of course, I still don't know what it is. But, hey, that's what friendships are built around, right? Secrets and mysteries.
You're something of a drama queen, aren't you?
A dagger straight into my heart.
Nick grasped his chest and leaned back in his chair. His hands slumped to his sides. He was dead. His life ended before its prime by the harsh words of someone he had thought of as a fast-growing friend. But hark, one of his hands began to lift, oh so slowly, made its way to the table, and grabbed the hamburger before raising it triumphantly to his mouth.
I don't even want to know what's going on in your head right now.
Good call.
Vince pushed away his now-forgotten chicken strips. Nick was loud, indiscreet, and showy. But he was also the only person to try to be Vince's friend in years. And he knew what it had been like for Vince before. Those two qualities alone made him someone Vince knew he'd need to keep around.
Get a book of matches and meet me back at the dorm.
You're supposed to wait until midterms before you go all pyro on shit.
I'm not going pyro. I just... Look, you said you wanted to know what I can do, right?
Why, yes. Yes, I do.
Then get a book of matches and meet me in the dorm.
Vince pulled up the remainder of his food and walked away from the table. He dumped his refuse in the bin and made his way to the exit. He was relatively certain it would take Nick a few minutes to find some matches and finish his burger. Vince was counting on those extra minutes because if he was going to try to do something with his power, he needed to get prepared and focused.
No way he's that fast.
Vince had only been in the room for a few minutes. He hopped up from his bed and opened the door.
Hey, I got my fish.
Nick mumbled through a mouthful of burger.
How did you find matches so quickly?
Nick made his way over to the computer chair and sat.
They were lying on the ground by the door when I left the dining hall.
Let me guess, you used your powers.
Sure did. I wanted to get this show on the road.
Fantastic. Just what I need.
Okay, see, now I'm confused. You're the one who volunteered to show me what you can do. What's the problem?
I guess it's nothing, really. I just get nervous about using my ability.
Still? Didn't you go through 2 months of therapy to get used to controlling it?
Nick took a last bite of hamburger and polished off his lunch, tossing the burger wrapper into a garbage bin under the desk. He sat, staring expectantly.
Yes, and I can control it, mostly. It's just that there are some aspects to it I'm still working on. Look, it should be fine. If we use matches, then everything will be okay.
Sweet. So, what do I do?
Just face me and light a match, then hold it up in front of you.
Vince sat down on the edge of the bed so that he was only a few feet from Nick.
Can do.
Nick pulled a book of matches from his pocket and carefully extracted one from the end. Vince noticed the matchbook had a few missing from it already. It was a pretty decent guess that Nick had focused his luck and some poor smoker had dropped their matches without noticing. Nick tried to light the match he had plucked with all the skill of a drunken hobo. On his fourth try, he finally got the match head to ignite. Vince's eyes were locked on the flame, focusing on it with all of his concentration. He raised his hand and opened it so that his palm was level with the match. For a few seconds, nothing happened. Then, the flame began to lean toward Vince's palm. Suddenly, there was a small burst of heat, and Nick was pinching only a tiny piece of ash between his fingers.
Whoa! What did you do?
I absorbed the energy of the flame. That's my ability. I can absorb energy and store it for later.
What do you mean, for later?
Nick pulled another match from the book. In response, Vince held up the index finger on his right hand. A small flame appeared at the tip of his finger. A flame about the same size and intensity as the one he had just vanquished. It burned for a few seconds, then vanished, just as quickly as it had appeared.
I can use the energy I absorb anytime I want. I can use it slowly, like I just did now, or release it in controlled bursts. In this case, it would have made a tiny fireball. I don't have the ability to extend or increase it, though. However much energy I absorb is what I have to work with.
Awesome. Now, do this one.
Vince couldn't deny this was good practice. So,
He accommodated his dorm mate's demands for entertainment and absorbed the rest of the matches one by one until they reached the final match in the book.
I have another question for you.
Shoot.
Vince's mind had wandered off, focused instead on how the aching and weariness he had been fending off seemed to be decreasing a bit in his absorbing hand. He wondered if using a part of his body as an absorption point had pain-fighting properties.
I get that you absorb the flame as it exists, but why is it every time you use your power, I wind up holding nothing but a fleck of ash? Does stealing the energy destroy the matchstick?
Nick blew away the small piece of ash that Vince's last absorption had left on his fingernails.
Yes and no. Remember when I said I was still getting the hang of some stuff? Well, that's what I meant. See, I don't just absorb existing energy. I absorb the potential energy as well. At least I do if I don't sever the connection.
Yeah. I've really got no idea what you're talking about.
Okay. How do I explain this? Look, let's pretend that you have another match and you light it, okay?
Sure. Why not?
Now, if you leave the match be, the fire will eventually consume all of the wood. However, if you were to lick your fingers and put it out halfway through, then you would still have some of the matchstick left. With me so far?
Mostly.
Good. Well, obviously the match that is allowed to burn all the way down produces more fire, and therefore more energy. See? That's why the match disintegrates in your hand. When I steal the energy of the flame, I don't just take all the energy that's there. I also take all of the energy that has the potential to be there.
I don't suppose you could break that down a little easier, could you?
Nick pulled out his dice and began fiddling with them.
Think of it like this. There is only ash in your hand because in a fraction of a second where I begin drawing on the energy of the match, the whole thing burns in a flash and is taken into my body. That makes sense?
Actually, yeah. But if it burns all at once, then why aren't my fingers singed? I mean, if I'm holding it and it burns, it should hurt.
You're not totally wrong. Normally, that would still burn you. But heat is a form of energy, and I'm taking everything the match has to give. So while it might flash burn in your fingers, all the heat flows into me.
Dude, I get it, but your power's fucking complicated.
This from the guy whose ability works on quantum probabilities?
I don't know what you're talking about. I just control luck. Nothing complicated about that.
Right. Nothing complicated about that.
Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport sat at a small cafe in Paris, sipping their respective coffees. They had been saddled with a busy day so far. However, they were provided with a nice gap at lunchtime. So Mr. Transport had suggested they adjourn to one of their favorite dining establishments. Mr. Numbers had concurred, and they left the sweltering plains of Africa for a more tranquil and enjoyable environment in which to dine. As was their custom, they were reviewing the particulars of their next assignment before departing. Mr. Transport had been surprised to see that it was classified as long-term. Those assignments were quite rare, given his and Mr. Numbers' capabilities for handling things in a prompt and efficient manner. The deeper he read into the dossier, the more concerned Mr. Transport grew.
Mr. Numbers?
Yes, Mr. Transport?
Mr. Numbers did not look up from his own copy of the assignment file.
Do you feel that perhaps there was a misfile and we were given someone else's assignment?
Oh, the possibility crossed my mind. However, if you read on, you will see certain accommodations at the target's place of employment have been made specifically for us. It even references us by name several times.
Mr. Transport flipped a few pages ahead, and sure enough, Mr. Numbers had been correct.
Very well. Just wanted to be certain we were deployed to the right area.
Quite understandable. It would be irresponsible of us agents to allow time and resources to be wasted on a clerical error. Since that is not the case, though, it seems we have a few more hours until we begin our new assignment.
That it does. Perhaps we should use that time to pack and prepare, so we're properly equipped for the full term of the assignment.
Excellent idea. Would you mind depositing me first, then swinging back by in an hour or so to pick me up?
Not at all.
Mr. Transport reached into his wallet and pulled out a few bills. He set the money on the table, careful to tip generously. A moment later, he and Mr. Numbers were gone. Across the cafe, An elderly gentleman glanced at their table and noticed their absence. He nonchalantly folded his paper, set some money on his own table, and headed off to make a phone call. The man had not tipped nearly as well as Mr. Transport. Several thousand miles away, in the middle of the Arctic tundra, Mr. Transport and Mr. Numbers reappeared.
How long?
Mr. Numbers tested the speed of the wind.
3 minutes, 14 seconds until health problems begin to set in.
Watch is set for 3 minutes.
Mr. Transport quickly fiddled with the high-priced device on his wrist. Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport were very careful when they wanted to talk openly. They always selected areas with no possible people to surround them, and abstract locales with ample background noise so that listening devices and GPS would be rendered ineffective. Mr. Numbers made sure they never used the same place twice and always kept their conversations under 5 minutes. Mr. Numbers was a very calculating man.
Now then, what do you actually make of our new assignment? Are we being punished?
For what? Our success rate is 98%. We finish our missions at the fastest time of any team, and we have had no recorded insubordination in the history of our career.
Then what would make them do this to us?
We mustn't assume the worst. Many of the reasons they had for putting us on this job are actually quite sound. They expect me to see any problems coming before they reach a critical point, and you'll be necessary in the event we need to evacuate ourselves and any others involved.
I don't imagine that's all there is to it.
Nor do I. Unfortunately, with the data I have, I don't yet know what the ulterior motive of placing us in this position is. The only option we have is the same one we've always had. Do our jobs, stick to the books, and give me enough time to see what's happening behind the scenes.
Do you think you'll be able to figure it out before we're stuck in whatever trap someone is planning?
I always have. Of course, that doesn't mean I always will, but I don't see any other options available to us, let alone any better ones.
Agreed.
Mr. Transport raised his watch and promptly turned off the alarm. Without another word, he nodded to Mr. Numbers. They reappeared in the apartment Mr. Numbers was currently renting under the name Mr. Digit. Mr. Transport tipped his head to Mr. Numbers, then vanished to go pack his bags. Mr. Numbers moved to pack up his own clothes, which consisted predominantly of suits, gathered his very few personal effects, and then bagged up the remainder of his possessions, which were his toiletries. The rooms would need to be cleaned of all the traces of their inhabitants, but the company had a department for that. They would also take care of setting up the rent and making sure no one asked questions about Mr. Digit's sudden departure. Mr. Numbers put out the fireplace, silenced his record player, and then took a moment to go to his window and pull back the thick black curtain. His eyes took in the splendor of Rome. From his vantage point, he had an excellent view of the Colosseum. That was why he had chosen this apartment in the first place. Mr. Numbers was not the type to get caught up in sentimentality or nostalgia, but he had to admit that he was going to miss this view. He wished he could rent this place again once his assignment was over. However, that was against protocol. Once an agent had left a place, he could never return. Mr. Numbers turned from the window as Mr. Transport reappeared, carrying a large brown tweed suitcase and a black duffel bag. He noticed a slight clinking sound coming from Mr. Transport's bag as he approached, and bit back his desire to chastise Mr. Transport for bringing along alcohol. Given what the duo would soon be doing, there was a strong possibility that Mr. Numbers would be seeking to partake.
Ready?
Of course.
Mr. Numbers, as if on cue, held his own baggage firmly so it wouldn't be left behind. And then, the room was empty, with only the warm Roman sunlight left to fill it.